May it please the court, counsel for the government. This case comes before this court with one overriding issue, the trial court's failure to vacate Mr. Cieslowski's plea that was neither intelligent nor voluntary. This case came in on September 20th, 01, the indictment, and 2 months later, a little over 2 months later, on December 6th, there was a plea of guilty. There was an agreement between the parties, an 11E1C, it was called in those days, which is 11C1C now, wherein the parties agreed that Mr. Cieslowski's offense level was a 35. Well, I think we can, first, the motivation for him to accept that was that there would be no upward departure. That was the motivation. No, that there would be no upward departure from the high end of the guidelines. This is an agreement about the high end of the guidelines. But it's not unassailable. If, in fact, there was a breach of contract by the government, as we say there was here, or there was a mutual mistake on an essential issue, then it can be invalidated, and that is our position. I believe we know what the government would have done by looking at the record in this case. The initial letter, it was an exhibit, it's an exhibit. The initial letter sent to Mr. Cieslowski's previous lawyer is, we are offering you the high end of the applicable guidelines without reference to the month. Never have been. We moved...
You want to knock it out?
And start over. Which is... Which is 20 years. Statutory maximum is... He got 17 and a half. I don't think they can run consecutive. I know the government has proposed that this man could get 160 years. By the way, it was 150 years. Because count three was only a 5-year. And the government said it was 15-year. But that aside... I think he might not. I think one of the issues which would be raised, which is not of record, is that the two alleged acts of child exploitation were indeed just... So there would be trial issues that have not been put in this record. But I think the key is here that there were so many options for this judge to vacate this guilty plea. Legitimate, just reasons. It was pre-sentence. And... We initially raised ineffective assistance based on failure to file motions. And then, when we learned of the guideline problem, we raised gross misinformation by the trial lawyer. Then on top of that, there was mutual mistake. And on top of that, which is breach of contract, which I think is a very large issue here. Yes. With regard to, you mean the misinformation about the guidelines? But, well, I'm not picking on her. I'm doing what I was asked to do, actually, by that office. Because there's a certain duty to your to know the law, to investigate the law, inform the client of what you're actually looking at. This wasn't mistaken. I know the government makes much of that. It was not a bad prediction case. It was a failure to investigate the law, and we were held responsible for that. I don't care whether 10 laws come out on the same day. That's our job. But I do think the breach of contract is a really large issue, and maybe your honors don't agree with me, but the government's position is that, okay, yeah, we agree that we said the high end of the guidelines, and yeah, we agree that we made a mistake. But all we did was answer Judge Jarrett's questions. Look at the record. That is not true. I think that the U.S. attorney could have answered his questions, but in the brief, I've laid out what they actually did, and there is a myriad of cases that say they can't go this far. They started out talking to the judge and telling the judge that if he was going to accept that number, he had to vacate the plea. That's how they started out. And that's in the record on the 423 hearing. Then the judge basically asked the parties, well, if the sentence contemplated in the plea agreement cannot be legally imposed, then I should vacate the plea. And then the government started to equivocate, promising Mr. Cieslowski in exchange. In the 423.03, colloquy. Let me see if I can give you a page. I don't have the page, Judge, but basically, I'm not care. I do. The government tells the court basically that at pages transcript SR volume 1 pages 10 through 13 at page 28 of the brief, Mr. Sussman basically, when the judge asks him, are you barred under this? The government starts reiterating its position that the court can upward depart. And on page 28, Sussman says, Judge, we don't agree, the defense and I, the government disagree as to whether if your honor were to on your own depart from the guideline range would be a breach. And then the court says, in my brief. And then the court says, it's the government's position I could depart from the agreed upon position, and Mr. Cieslowski could not withdraw his plea, and the government says as long as it's 210 months. So they start to push, is what I'm telling you. And then the judge says, brief it. And they don't mildly brief it. They have a strong position. They cite Barnes. Actually, they miscite Barnes. And here we go. This judge is persuaded. They suggested, actually, that the court impose a sentence that violated the spirit of the agreement. Well, just what I read to you, Judge, was proposing it. Yeah, I think it's actually telling the judge to suggesting a sentence that violates the agreement. I think it goes way beyond that. I mean, it's replete in the record. Well, no, it's in my brief. It's throughout my brief. I've quoted the pages in my brief. Starting at page 27, I talk about the violation. And in my reply brief at page 4 forward, I suggest to the court and cite various sections of the brief where things started to go awry. On page 12 of my reply brief, I say, at first the government explained if the court agreed with the guideline calculations contained in the PSI, then essentially it was rejecting the plea agreement, it must allow the defendant to withdraw. That's SR volume 1, page 3. And then I go on to say the government agreed with defense counsel that the court could not impose the sentence within the guideline range that was agreed upon by the parties. Same volume, same page. And then I go on to say the government began to equivocate, suggesting the court could impose an upward departure to put the sentence where it needed to be. It at page 4, same volume. then, notwithstanding the fact that it was legally barred, requesting an upward departure, the government pressed the notion that the plea could be saved if the court imposed an upward departure. One prosecutor noted, "I don't want to give up the argument there is no basis." That's a violation. Mr. Cieslowski, and I want to sit down, I don't know how much rebuttal time I have left, but Mr. Cieslowski gave up his right to not be sentenced at the upward departure in exchange, he gave up his right for no upward departures in exchange for taking a high end of a mistaken guideline. I don't agree, Judge. Santabella says it, but was implicit in the agreement. That was the agreement. Yes, sir. Not in the written plea agreement, but implicit in at the bargaining table. The government does not dispute that they could not upward depart. They do not dispute that. The government does not dispute that they could not, that they would not ask for an upward departure. I'm not saying they should have lied, but they urged it.
They didn't.
They couldn't very well be that blatant.
Well, don't say they urged it. What you're really saying is, the words they used conveyed to the judge something that was urged.
They furnished the information also.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Monica Bickert, and I represent the United States in this matter. The district court did not abuse its discretion when it denied the defendant's motion to vacate his plea based on any of the reasons cited by defense counsel in her brief, specifically that there was a mutual mistake as to the guideline calculations, or that there was ineffective assistance of counsel, or that the government, in fact, somehow breached the plea agreement at sentencing. Your Honor is correct that there is no way of knowing. It's beyond the record. There's no way of knowing what would have happened had... Your Honor, in plea agreements, there are always unknowns. And
most of the plea agreements...
In fact, Your Honor, the reason it's not is because although the parties did agree under 11E1C to a term of 210 months, that very language that Your Honor was mentioning about these are preliminary guideline calculations, the sentence could, the guideline range could be different, those were all contained in the plea agreement. I believe that the distinction in the plea agreement is a distinction between what the guideline range is going to be and what sentences the parties have agreed upon. The parties did not agree to the high end of the guideline range. They agreed to 210 months. That's the 11E1C term in the plea agreement. Your Honor, respectfully, in all plea agreements and even in 11E1C agreements, there's no way for the parties to know precisely what the guideline range is going to be. Here, that 210-month sentence was agreed upon by the parties. Was it strictly because it was predicted to be the high end of the guideline range? Maybe. There's no way of knowing for sure what the government's analysis was there or what the defendant's analysis was there. But certainly, defendant's trial counsel during the December hearing at which he testified said that part of their reason was that they feared upward departures and that there were several bases for upward departures that could be imposed here. One way or another, the sentence was unclear. There could be changes in the guideline range, and that happens all the time, or there could be an upward departure by the district court judge. The 210-month number was agreed upon as a concrete number because it limited for the parties the chance that guideline range could be off in a substantial way, that there could be multiple upward departures, or that the guideline range could just be wrong in the way it was calculated, which it turned out to be. But that was something that the defendant bargained for and something that he agreed to, and he should be held to that. Yes, Your Honor. There were two bases for departures that even the defendant's trial counsel, during her testimony, referred to. And one of those was the one that the district court did use, which was for a large number of child pornographic images. The upward departure could have been greater than the two-level upward departure that the district court here imposed. I believe, Your Honor, under 2G2.4, the upper departure is either 4 or 6 levels that is expressly permitted there. And here the district court imposed 2. And of different children, Your Honor. There were some that were of the same. There were some that were repeats. But there were over 8,000 images on the defendant's computer. Your Honor, I believe there was evidence in the record of him corresponding over the internet, but I'm afraid I cannot speak specifically to the distribution. Oh, I'm sorry, whether there was. The other theory, in fact, relates to the internet communications, and that is that the defendant's criminal history was underrepresented. And that would be because there was evidence that the defendant had, in fact, been engaged on the Internet in conversations enticing a minor to engage in prohibited sexually explicit conduct. Yes, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. There could have been a reasonable departure made by the district court judge that would have exceeded the 210-month sentence imposed. Well, Your Honor, the mutual mistake cases that are addressed in both parties' briefs, I do think, rely on the principles of contract law. But this court doesn't have to look beyond the cases that specifically address this issue, because this court, in fact, has addressed the issue. It's a fair question, Your Honor, and the answer in this case is to look at the text of the contract, the plea agreement, in which the parties expressly allowed for that ambiguity in the calculation of the guideline range. And I'm not referring to just paragraph 7W in the plea agreement. I'm referring to the entire text of the plea agreement, where there is, in paragraph 8, language that the parties are free to change the guideline calculations before sentencing, and that the defendant still would not be able to withdraw from the contract. And in paragraph 9, that the defendant understands that his maximum term of imprisonment on the count to which he pled guilty is 20 years. All throughout this contract are provisions allowing for the very ambiguity that Your Honor is suggesting. With regard to whether the government breached the plea agreement, the government did not equivocate and it did not urge the district court to impose this departure. In fact, the government stood by what it agreed to in the plea agreement, which was that it would not request an upward departure. The government began to tell the district court that the district court could depart on its own motion when the district court indicated to the government that it didn't know whether or not it had the authority to depart. Furthermore, in paragraph 15 of the plea agreement, the language reads that the defendant understands that the government will fully inform the district court and the probation office, that would be determining the guideline range, of the nature and the scope and the extent of the defendant's conduct, including aggravating and mitigating factors. So to the extent that, as defense counsel points out, the government in fact informed the court about the defendant's additional conduct, possessing the 8,000 images that allowed for this upward departure, first, they were already contained in the plea agreement, and second, the government in the plea agreement had said that it could talk about these aggravating factors to the court. To do anything less would be to not be fully truthful with the court, and the government was not willing to do that. And finally, Your Honor, with regard to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, specifically that the inaccurate prediction of the sentence by defense counsel somehow constitutes deficiency on the part of counsel, no deficiency was shown here. And the district court was proper in denying the motion to vacate based on this ground. Your Honor, this court has considered this issue several times, in recent years, in fact, and has found that the mere prediction, inaccurate prediction, under the guide. Well, in these other cases that the Seventh Circuit has addressed, they have sort of set forth, this court has set forth the path under which these cases should be analyzed. And in fact, in cases involving mistakes in reading the applicable law, in fact, sometimes gross mistakes in the calculation of sentences, this court has found that there's no deficiency unless counsel actually failed to conduct a good faith inquiry into what the proper law was. Here, the difference here is that this is a change in whether or not there is actually jurisdiction over the case could be viewed as a more significant misreading of the law. This was a change in the sentencing guidelines that went. And certainly that's the case, and the government is not saying that in every case where there is some sort of miscalculation that there cannot be ineffective assistance of counsel. The defense attorney does have the obligation to make that good faith inquiry. However, here, Your Honor, here, where the sentencing regime was quite complicated, there were a number of guidelines that applied. And the guideline that went into effect 1 month before the defendant pled guilty here, where the plea negotiations had long been going on, and in fact the government had sent a draft plea agreement back in the summer to defense counsel. Here, the change in the guideline dealt with the way the defenses were grouped. It did not specifically apply to the offense at hand. No, I'm not saying that defense counsel should not have known about it. I'm simply saying that in the spectrum of cases here, this is a more reasonable type of mistake for defense counsel to make than in the cases such as Martinez and Barnes that the Seventh Circuit has considered. Thank
you. With regard to the mutual mistake issue, I think that contract law does apply, as you so indicated. And I think it is particularly appropriate in this case. The restatement of contracts, I think, explains clearly where a mistake of both parties at the time a contract was made as to a basic assumption on which the contract was made has a material effect on the agreed exchange of performances. And that's our position here. The fact that my client was misinformed about the proper guidelines and then agreed to the high end of a mistaken guideline was. I think that we, when we're looking at the mutual mistake, we look at the time the contract was made and what the parties were thinking. And I think it's actually, I don't think it's disputed by the government that it was the high end of the guidelines. Ms. Fisher, not what the written contract says, but a mutual mistake can occur. Quoted in my brief. Contract, but I think that because he's a defendant and there are due process rights, I don't think that we can just discard the fact that there was a mutual mistake in the intent of the parties. I was.